Vicarious Sovereignty, Becoming European the Estonian Way, interview with Maria Malksoo. Tere, and welcome to History of Estonia podcast, where we explore the fascinating past and present of this Baltic nation. I'm your host, William Parsley, and today I have a very special guest with me. She is a Professor Maria Malksoo, a leading scholar of international relations, security studies, and memory politics. She is currently working at the Department of Political Science at the University of Copenhagen, where she leads several research projects on the politics of memory and deterrence in Europe. She has a PhD in International Studies from the University of Cambridge and has previously taught at the University of Kent and the University of Tartu. She is the author and co-author of several books and articles on the politics of becoming European, Remembering Katyn, and uses of, quote, the East in international studies. She is also an associate editor of Review of International Studies and has previously served as the president of the Central and East European International Studies Association. Professor Malksoo, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure.
What is vicarious sovereignty, and how does it relate to Estonia's membership in the EU?
Vicarious sovereignty is a practical reconciliation attempt of the distinct pools of independent sovereignty and Europeanness. So in that sense, it's something that Estonia, as a small state in a geopolitically contested space, has actually known all too well throughout its process of becoming European post-1991. Now, when I talk about this becoming European process or the politics of becoming European, I should clarify that I mean it both in the sense, in the institutionalist sense of, you know, what Central and Eastern European states had to undergo from the accession negotiations in 1997 to the EU membership in 2004. But I also refer to the politics of becoming European in a deeper identitarian sense. Mm-hmm. That is, as the process of seeking recognition to these states, including Estonia's Europeanness, to their European belonging, to their European identity, and seeking that recognition from they considered and what has historically been considered to be the authoritative carriers of European identity, that is the Western European states, the Western part of the continent. So when we talk about vicarious sovereignty, we have to talk first about vicarious identification. And that's a bit of a tongue twister on both accounts, actually, because in order to conceptually understand this notion, we need to understand what vicarious identification actually stands for. And it stands for essentially living through another. Mm-hmm. That is, it also refers to the way actors appropriate the achievements and experiences of others to gain a sense of purpose or identity or self-esteem themselves. Now, vicarious itself is a complex word and not immediately self-explanatory word. We can think of vicarious as pertaining to acting or done for another, mm-hmm. but it can also refer to you know, if you look at the dictionary, substitute or second hand or derivative or surrogate. But effectively, vicarious identity then would be something that can be delegated, or something that can be substituted, something that can be understood as interchangeable with the identity of another. That's the argument some of my good colleagues have made in a recent book dedicated to vicarious identity in international relations. So I took this idea of theirs and have been sort of trying to stretch it to the realm of sovereignty, because I think we can see that craving such vicarious identity, which in Estonia's case would be, of course, European identity, particularly at the critical time where this recognition seeking was yet in progress. But craving or coveting such an identity is something we can also consider as a form of ontological security seeking. Basically, seeking the sense of secure self through getting this recognition from these authoritative others.
Okay.
And it's, of course, not uncommon among states to seek that sense of ontological security and self-esteem through locating oneself or ourselves as members of broader, for instance, civilizational communities, through seeking to also vicariously appropriate certain elements from a particular broader tradition or achievements of this broader tradition in order to, you know, enhance or at least preserve or establish our own status. Now, when we build on this idea of vicarious identification, we can, of course, see that such identification with Europe has really been constitutive for Estonia's pooling of important aspects of its own sovereign power with the European Union. And this has happened at the same time when Estonia has also kept this at least nominal commitment to very absolute understanding of sovereignty in its national constitution. So this is how we get to this notion of vicarious sovereignty, which to boil it down is basically sovereignty that is achieved or buttressed, or sovereignty that is executed through the act of sharing it or pooling it. And in that sense, vicarious sovereignty is actually a very curious kind of sovereignty. So it emerges by the very act of pooling national authority with other polities, in that case with the European Union, and thereby then supposedly elevating states' agency in international politics. So it is a type of sovereignty that materializes itself actually through membership in another polity. And in a way, you could say that it's a sovereignty that happens through a state's willing self-subjugation to these other polities' recognized supremacy for the very sake of generating thus this sense of security of being or ontological security. But I think this vicarious sovereignty conceptually is also a good illustration to what sovereignty really empirically or, you know, what sovereignty in practice really is. Because we have this ideal typical notion and also there is this traditionally conceived theoretical concept of sovereignty as something that is indivisible, that there is this ultimate authority that is vested in a single sovereign or a single institution within a political community. But de facto, sovereignty has always tended to be pretty divisible in practice. So it's empirically simply not really the case that it's indivisible. And the logic of this vicarious sovereignty in Estonian case has really then been that you know, by pooling sovereignty, the de facto ability to exist as an entity, as a political entity that can exercise its will in international community has been strengthened. That is the logic of Estonia in the European Union.
Thank you. Interesting. What were the motivations behind Estonia's decision to join the EU, and how did these motivations relate to its understanding of sovereignty?
I think it's pretty fair to say that Estonia's desire to join the EU was also fundamentally security driven, and of course not just ontological security driven, if you will. You know, here I think it's productive to look back into these debates that actually unfolded at the time when the process of the EU accession unfolded and happened. For instance, the then president of Estonia, Lennart Meri, put it pretty concisely and matter-of-factly in one of his interviews given in 1997. It was actually the end of the year interview back in 1997. And he sort of said, without mincing words, that the EU membership is something that is necessary for the continuation of the Estonian state. Which, you know, in a way says it all, because we now maybe have sort of been reminded of in what kind of a geopolitical environment Estonia still lives in. But back then, before the EU and NATO membership, I mean, everything was so much more fluid and in flux, you could say, and also pretty much dangerous or defenseless, if you will, even if, you know, everyone wanted to think that that Russia was also something different after the end of the Cold War and the collapse of the USSR. The fact was that joining the institutional Europe was something that was fundamentally understood as the political security guarantee. And I guess, you know, it obviously still is, but particularly back then, it was considered essential for guarding Estonia's sovereign statehood, which, you know, as we know, and the audience of this podcast probably also well knows, that that this statehood was lost to the Soviet Union in the course of the Second World War, right, and then has been reinstated on the doctrine of the legal continuity of the Republic of Estonia in 1991. So this was sort of, you know, one important element of the story. Of course, NATO was regarded as the military side of the coin, but also NATO was a little bit less reachable a goal back at the time. And ironically, perhaps we have also learned in the course of this sort of Russia's growing appetite to again play the first violin in the region, and you know, its growing aggressiveness, particularly against Ukraine, you know, at least since 2013-14, we also have learned that in a way this assumption that NATO was really, you know, the military security guarantee should also be seen now with a certain qualification, because NATO proved to be much more of a political security guarantee as well up until, you know, effectively 2014 and what has come after. But when we come back to the EU, Estonia was actually the first of the former Soviet republics to start the accession negotiations with the European Union in 1998. And it became a member of the European Union along with nine other, mostly Central East European countries, on 1st of May 2004. Now, when we look at the sort of constitutional side of the story, to enable the accession with the European Union, there was this act that was passed following the referendum of 2003 in Estonia, and it was called the Accession to the EU and the Supplementary Act to the Constitution, which is an interesting document from a legal perspective. Now, I'm not a lawyer, but I trust the legal scholars who have said that it's an interesting document because it indeed carefully navigates the formal amendment to the Constitution, and it sort of, you know, is called a supplementary act. But in fact, you know, regardless of what it is called, it really did not just supplement the Constitution of the Republic, but it actually also still sort of changed the certain spirit or supremacy logic there. So the Act's provision that the Constitution, and I quote, is applied without prejudice to the rights and obligations arising from the accession treaty. This has been interpreted in the judgments of the Supreme Court in a way that actually grants EU law primacy here. So one could say that, you know, in this striving to be recognized as a good European, Estonia's implementation of EU law has generally been without reservations. So there has been this primacy that has been actually granted to European Union law over the national constitution. And that's interesting against the backdrop of this constitutionally unequivocal commitment that is there in the Estonian constitution to the conservative notion of sovereignty. So there is a certain, you know, tension or discrepancy, if you will, there. Because if you look at the Article 1 of Estonia's constitution as it was adopted in 1992, it states that Estonia is an independent and sovereign democratic republic wherein the supreme power of state is vested in the people. The independence and sovereignty of Estonia are timeless and inalienable. And, you know, against the backdrop of this very sort of affirmative, conservative, indivisible notion of sovereignty, we have de facto granting the sort of supremacy to the EU, in Estonia's case, above this constitution. But this all made sense against the backdrop of, you know, the perception that was there then, and that is there again, if you will, if it ever really went away, this general perception of Russia as at least a potential and potential and existential threat to the Estonian statehood. So the membership in the EU was supposed to provide a political remedy to this perceived threat, and hence, you know, the entrusting of some of its sovereignty to the EU competence, and of course, you know, by that the absolute sovereignty of Estonia would be naturally reduced to a degree, but the logic was that the benefits from the international cooperation would be obviously higher. You know, you get the enhanced security provisions, and hence comparatively the losses would be less compared to what was there to gain.
Fascinating. Thank you. How did Estonian policymakers and intellectuals envision Estonia's role in the EU during the Convention on the Future of Europe?
Yes, that's an interesting moment that seems almost like ancient history now, but I think it's a so this convention on the future of the European Union, or very shortly the European Convention, was a body that was established by the European Council in 2001, and it had a very, you know, specific task. The task was to reorder the existing treaty base to sustain the EU's functionality in light of the then pending enlargement. Now, why it's interesting as a sort of historical moment in the context of which to look at some of these debates over, you know, European identity and belonging to Europe, and also the future of Europe, because that was fundamentally also the gist of the convention, is precisely that these future member states could also participate in these discussions, and hence it becomes this sort of right forum to observe and to pay attention to in order to actually see what was the mood of the day, so to speak, and also perhaps to learn from this saturated moment, if you will, of thinking intensely about these issues. Now, the main issues, that's, you know, I should give a little bit of the backdrop before we can talk about what the Estonian interventions were in this particular debate. But the main issues that were discussed at the convention then concerned basically the ways of making the EU more democratic and more transparent, and also, you know, the modes of streamlining the decision-making processes, the division of competences between the EU institutions and member states and the relevant regional organizations. Also questions such as how to include national parliaments at the EU level, and of course, how to make the European Union's common foreign and security policy more effective. And the membership was also, membership of this convention was also a pretty varied bunch. It consisted of the representatives of the Commission, of the European Parliament, then the delegates of the member, but also, as I said, the candidate states, governments and national parliaments, so each of whom had the right to send one governmental and two parliamentarian representatives to this convention. So it was, in a way, this grand exercise in European democracy and future imagining, and perhaps, if you know, some might say future manifestation, right? Mm-hmm. So in all, there were 28 states, 217 representatives who participated in the work of the convention, which was then led by the former French president Valéry Giscard d'Estaing. And the Estonian government was represented at the convention by the former president Lennart Meri. There were also deputy members, and the parliament representatives were Tunne Kelam and Rein Lang. And then there was also, you know, there was a change, like latter former parliament formation, Peter Kreitzberg at some point. Now, what is again interesting here is, from Estonia's perspective, was that Estonia was at the time still, of course, a candidate country of the EU. And in that context, this participation opportunity in the discussions over the future shape and the future face of the European Union, effectively on par with the established member states, was, of course, a valued opportunity. Effectively on par means that the candidate states could still not block the consensus of the member states in this context. So in a way, you know, when we think of this moment or this particular forum, this convention enabled Estonia to speak along in imagining the future of the European institutions and member states' division of labor in governance in spe. So in a way, it was this very practical, hands-on opportunity to practice the politics of becoming European and soon being European. Now, I think for Lennart Meri, perhaps in particular, this convention perhaps felt quite like a symbolic homecoming. His speeches, whoever cares to read them, are fundamentally about the question of what Europe is and what does it mean to be European. So so, you know, going further back in his speeches, one can, for instance, find themes such as, you know, when we create a new Europe, we have at the same time have to create a new European. And elsewhere he would say that one is not born European, one becomes European, and no one has a monopoly on Europe. So in a way, these earlier themes that he had expressed, of course, now in this context of the convent, were something that he could himself, bring to fruition, almost to participate in these discussions about, what Europe is and what to make of it. So in that sense, it definitely, this future convention of the European Union provided Mary certainly with an opportunity to enact his belief that Europe is not just a continent, but it's a program, as he said. It's a philosophical program, it's an ethical, cultural, political, and economic program. And of course, when we talk about homecoming, it was also fundamentally about now Estonia again being at the table, not on the table, not in the menu, but actually being able to participate in these discussions. So it was, I think one way to think of it, of this convention, from Estonia's and perhaps other candidate states' perspective, was to think of it as a very hands-on political identity building forum for the EU, and then the proud younger participants in the process. Now, practically speaking, there was a number of issues that, in one way or the other have been resurfacing in these EU, perhaps endless EU debates about how it must reform itself in order to be more efficient. These debates don't grow old as the EU keeps enlarging, right? But, these debates effectively were about how to divide the competencies, between EU institutions, member states, and this question really also polarized larger and smaller member states. And here, Estonia joined back in the day the initiative of 16 small states against the creation of the European president's position, and also arguing for the sustaining the balance between the EU institutions and member states as provided by the EU foundational treaties. So there were certain bottom lines that Estonia was sort of standing for. And perhaps it's in a way, I don't know, maybe it's sad or symptomatic, but it is actually notable that still decades post, or almost two decades post accession, Central and Eastern Europeans are actually still severely underrepresented in the EU institutions. And this was something that these countries were concerned about, of course, already at the time before they even had become members. So some, things the Estonian representatives in the convention were in favor of. For instance, one of these principles was this infamous subsidiarity principle, which essentially stands for powers being exercised as close to the citizen as possible. So, they argued for all the nice things that are difficult to disagree with, right? Such as, decision-making process should be lean and uncomplicated, and Estonia, for instance, also was emphatically opposed to the qualified majority voting in the realm of taxation policy. So that was maybe an interesting element. If I mention some other representatives in the convention, for instance, Tunne Kelam, stressed that the competences that have been given to the EU institutions should be understood as effectively delegated competences, or competences that are on loan from and by the member states. So there was this sort of also the fear of the emergence of, the European super state, and hence the emphasis that Estonia needs to be able to continue as a dignified nation state in a union of nation states rather than in a sort of more federalist union. But again, there were different positions, and one of these more more sort of federalism leaning positions was also expressed by Toomas Hendrik Ilves in his capacity of the Estonian Minister of Foreign Affairs at the time. And I guess, you know, again, also against the backdrop of the themes that this convention covered, he made a very strong argument for Estonia's full participation in the EU's common foreign and security policy. And the logic was that, you know, through this participation, the national foreign policy would grow only stronger, because then Estonia would get the weight of the EU behind us, and hence it would be able to pursue issues that are actually of vital importance to Estonia. So this was something that that he expressed pretty strongly in the speeches given at the time or around the time of the convention as well. Now again, you know, it's you know, you could take this as an instance of vicarious identification and vicarious sovereignty, perhaps. And it's also interesting to observe that in later practice, Estonia has been rather reluctant towards surrendering its competences in security and defense to the EU. It has preferred in that realm to actually pool its sovereignty with NATO instead. So it has been perhaps less trusting on that front, also because of the intricacies of the EU, EU's sort of security and defense profile as an actor. But yes, to sort of conclude on this, so Estonia, in a way, sort of sought this membership, and of course exercised also its voice in these debates in order to secure its ability to be in the first place, right? But then, you know, if you would offer more critical reading of you know, all this sovereignty pooling, if you will, as some national conservatives perhaps would, you could suggest that, well, you know, before it even managed to grow into a proper state after regaining independence and restoring its sovereignty in 1991, the political elite already hurried to share this newly regained sovereignty. I mean, that's of course, you know, that's not my reading, but it's one reading that one can offer as a critical counterpoint. But what became clear in these discussions that you asked about in these discussions at this convention was this implicit tension between a nation state's Europe and then the idea of a more congealed post-sovereign structure. So if you will, you know, that this tension could be read from these positions that are indicated between Tunne Kelam, who was speaking more for the nation states Europe, and then Toomas Ilves, who was more open to explore the sort of post-sovereign structure for the European Union. But these were broadly these Estonia's practical sovereignty dilemmas at the cusp of the EU membership more generally, I believe.
Thank you. You mentioned Lennart Meri and Toomas Hendrik Ilves. There are two prominent Estonian political figures that argued for distinct visions of Europe at the time of the convention, Lennart Meri and Toomas Hendrik Ilves. What would you highlight as their key contributions in the discussions of the convention on the future of the European Union in the early 2000s?
Mm-hmm. Yes, as I said, Meri was actually the Estonian government's representative at the convention. Ilves, you know, spoke about these issues in his capacity as Estonia's Minister for Foreign Affairs at the time of the convention's deliberations. And indeed, his intervention, at least in the public realm, you know, what we all could observe and reflect on, I think has proven to be really one of the most noteworthy political interventions in this debate. And his intervention was simply the most important talk on the subject was his lecture that he gave in 2001 at Humboldt University in Berlin. Mm-hmm. And as it happens, I actually was also physically present in the audience. I was a student of the University of Tartu at the time, and I was visiting my older brother, who was writing his PhD in international law at Humboldt at the time. And we were both attending the lecture, and it was a very, very interesting event also in terms of the, you know, the German reactions from the audience. But yes, both of them, both Meri and Ilves, in a way, have given a certain speech that we can take as an exemplary position articulation, in a way, back in the day. And they both presented also their distinct political visions in these speeches for the future of Europe. So if I point out one, because Lennart Meri obviously, you know, as I said, spoke on these themes pretty extensively, but if I would have to point at one, I would think of the speech that he made at the University of Turku in Finland, on the role of small nations in the European Union. And this was made in May 2000. And then, you know, this lecture by Ilves, I already mentioned, this was in February 2001. Now, when we look at these interventions, they both, I think, are most systematic, but also most visionary political engagements with the European constitutional future debates in Estonia. Now, that is not to say that, you know, there was not a broader discussion, and obviously there was, and also there was a broader discussion among the constitutional lawyers of Estonia. But when we look at the political level, I think these two political figures and these two speeches are really interesting to also reread in the context of the current debates, right, and discussions. But I think what is interesting is that both speeches actually also directly engage with one of the earlier contributions in this broader pan-European political debate over the future constitution of Europe, namely the one that was given by the German foreign minister Joschka Fischer in 2000. The speech was called "From Confederation to Federation: Thoughts on the Finality of European Integration." It was also given at Humboldt University in Berlin. And I think also for me, as an you know, somebody who works in the academia, it's you know, not an incidence that both of these noteworthy interventions by two politicians, Meri and Ilves, actually happened in the university environment. The speeches mm-hmm. were given under the sort of liberating cloak of academic freedom, if you will. So in that sense, they are by default more interesting than, you know, a speech that is given in a very sort of narrow political forum would be, mm-hmm. perhaps.
Thank you. What was then Lennart Meri's main argument in his speech at the University of Turku in the year 2000?
Mm-hmm. So this speech, which was called "The Role of Small Nations in the European Community," it makes a strong case for the democracy of Europe. And of course, you know, the development potential of the European Community as depending on sustaining the diversity on the continent. That was one of these leitmotifs that Meri, you know, kept coming back to throughout his sort of public work, so to speak. So this idea that there has to be, and the EU has to keep, an optimal balance between large and small states, this is one of the key tasks that he sees in front of Europe's future. So for instance, he would say that Europe needs small nations as much as we that is the small nations, need Europe, because the strength of Europe is precisely in its diversity. So this is very much speaking to these, you know, so in a more perhaps political and spiritual way to some of the pretty technocratic concerns that the convention also had to deal with or was tasked to deal with. So in that sense, of course, you know, this speech is also a nice speech to read because it's one that carries Mary's trademark metaphoric, allegoric language. It's a really sort of powerful hymn or ode to Europe's diversity and cultural multitude, and the logic that Europe should not worship quantity but quality, and the emphasis that greatness as a quality for Europe is actually something that is first and foremost spiritual. So he argues against this idea that big is beautiful in the European context, basically also, you know, of course, bringing in the message how the big states of Europe have to be considerate in all the political designs and redesigns of the EU institutions of the smaller member states. Now, why it's interesting to sort of juxtapose Mary and his vision with the later Thomas Hendrik Ilves's vision here on the future of Europe is that, of course, Mary is much more conservative and critical about this Eurofederalism idea. Mm-hmm. He maintains very explicitly that this Joschka Fischer's Eurofederalism should remain an academic excursus. It should not find application in the real world, as he puts it. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting again because you could say that, you know, it's not entirely, and it hasn't entirely remained an academic excurse when it comes to German politics. For instance, Germany's 2021 coalition agreement asserts support to the idea of constitutional convention and also further development of the union towards a federal European state. But, you know, sort of the gist of Mary's case is really to argue that small states should not be run over in the debates over the future constitution and setup of Europe, and the internal reforms of the EU should also not take place on account of the expansion of the union. So in a way, Mary really preaches the value and importance of state sovereignty in this speech. He maintains, for instance, that that this is such a sort of unique, almost like once in a lifetime self-realization opportunity of every nation, independent statehood, that is. And in that sense, it's also inalienable. But then, of course, you know, the reality is that as also this vicarious sovereignty concept suggests, that sometimes you need to pool a little of this inalienable quality in order to actually be able to exercise it in the political reality of the world or this particular environment you live in. So there is also a certain tempering of this ode to sovereignty that Mary sings in the speech with the reminder that small states actually have a special political mission in Europe. So they also need to maintain the balance in Europe and to continuously remind the big ones that, you know, they are there and they have this special function to fulfill or a role to play in Europe. So he has this beautiful sentence in the speech which says that small states are the lubricating oil of Europe and the mortar of Europe. So in that sense, I think it's an interesting intervention in the broader debate over the future political design of the EU. And we can see in the speech by Mary also this rather characteristic defiance that he so often exercised against defiance of or going against the grain of this what he sometimes described as feudal Eurocentrism of European enlargement debates. So, you know, the idea that Estonia is not just a geographical object in the enlargement process, but it's a constitutional subject. It's a state, and, you know, it has a voice, it has a mind, and it speaks the mind in this discussion, which should not be, as he said, something alike to the court of Louis the 14th, where only the specially selected are invited. So,
thanks. What was Thomas Hendrik Ilves's main argument in his lecture at Humboldt University in the year 2001?
Mm-hmm. Now, as I already mentioned, Ilves puts forth a much more federalism sympathetic vision for Europe's political future. So this was a lecture he gave as Estonia's foreign minister at the time at Humboldt University in 2001, February. The lecture was called Constructing a New Europe. And I think it probably has remained the best elaborated Estonian political contribution to the discussion on the European constitutionalism, even if, you know, as he emphatically emphasized, this was delivered in personal rather than state representative capacity. But of course, you know, we all know that once a foreign minister or, you know, a key spokesperson on certain issues, you can't really fully take that hat off, even if you try to expand this space where you speak, or the scope of speaking freely, as he did with his speech in this university environment. But it's an interesting speech which directly enters in dialogue with this aforementioned Joschka Fischer's inaugural intervention of the high-level political debate on the future of the European constitutionalism. So in this lecture, Ilves effectively called for building on the 18th century early American federalism as the intellectual source or, you know, inspiration for the future of EU integration. Because, as he argued, effectively 18th century America grappled with the issues which were identical to these issues that Europe was facing in the early 2000s. So these included, as he argued, the need to balance the interests of large and small constituent states. Of course, the question of how to distribute competences, such as, you know, what should belong to the prerogatives of the central government, what shouldn't, and also the issues of you know, how to ensure common defense and the creation of the monetary union. So there was a number of issues, pretty fundamental issues that the speech covered. First of all, there was this question that also his political trajectory, his political life has always been very intensely paying attention to the question of certain sort of top-down treatment that the old member states have given to the new member states. So he referred to this supposed cultural and psychological adjustment of the old members with the new members, who, as one of the German politicians at the time had reportedly put it, fundamentally differed from the existing EU member states when it came to their national emotional traditions and experiences and interests and value judgments. So you know, this was, of course, something that Ilves took strongly an issue with, whether this difference was really that, you know, fundamental and that essentialist, as this quote was alluding it to be. Mm-hmm. Then there was this question of, you know, small and large member states and how to sort of make them function together in the soon-to-be enlarged union. And then the question of democratic legitimacy versus effective decision-making. So Ilves effectively argued for a federalist approach, and not in the last order to ease this structural tension between small and large constituent members. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, you know, he also wanted to clarify what he took to be this misunderstanding about what is even the meaning of federalism and constitutionalism, and try to sort of take a step back and maybe you know, show that some of these fears were not warranted.
How did Ilves propose to solve the dilemma between democratic legitimacy and effective decision-making in the EU?
Yes, it was in that sense also a very constructive speech, if you will, because it's, as we all well know, it's easy to to be critical and it's easy to criticize, but to actually construct,
right,
you know, be it New Europe or suggest constructive alternatives is not that straightforward. So he made a case as part of this sort of constructive solution for a two-chamber European Parliament, a strong bicameral European Parliament as a sort of solution to the EU's democratic legitimacy problem, which he deemed to be unachievable, democratic legitimacy of the EU, that is, as long as this single chamber model with semi-proportional representation was to be maintained. He also tackled this question of subsidiarity and very much spoke for this idea of, you know, bottom-up legitimacy, so that the political authority would really ultimately come from the citizens. So not just nation states, but really the citizens would accede some decision making upwards to the union. And then, as I already touched upon, so he engaged directly with this dreaded F word, or federalism, and called for this sort of straightforward, no frills approach to the EU constitution. Suggesting that, you know, yes, the European Union can have a constitution without automatically ending up with a sort of super state or a super state. It's actually simply a pragmatic way to codify the relationship between citizens and the political process. So in that sense, I think because of this pretty systematic and bold engagement with some of the core ideas or also, you know, points of tension in this broader debate over the future of Europe and the EU constitution, I think this lecture in that sense is also an interesting utopian moment, if you will, in the Estonian contribution to imagining the European constitution, or you know, what the sort of setup politically and legally of the future EU could even be.
Great. What implications does the idea of vicarious sovereignty have for our understanding of sovereignty and European integration in the 21st century?
Yes, there always is this question of you know, whether this is now something that we can only observe in the context of Little Estonia, or whether there is this broader applicability of the vicarious sovereignty concept, perhaps, you know, within the Central East European region, but perhaps also beyond. And I think it's maybe The concept itself, the way I think of it, the way I have tried to sort of this certain discrepancy that I referred to between Estonian sort of traditional sovereignty as it has been stored in its constitution and the de facto pooling of it with the EU. I think it disturbs this idea that we have very often seen in the discussions over the post-communist constitutions, which by and large have been characterized as very souverainist or very protective of sovereignty compared to most of their Western European counterparts. So this is the argument that constitutional lawyers have frequently made in the context of Central and Eastern Europe. Now, I think Estonian practice and this evident sort of vicarious sovereignty practice in the run-up to the EU membership, in fact, problematizes or contests such a wholesale diagnosis that all East European nations have been sort of going for this strong sovereign power of the people in their version of constitutionalism. I think it's interesting that Estonia's pooling of sovereignty, when we compare, for instance, to the cases of Poland and Hungary, has clearly been publicly, at least, more effortless. It has been more enthusiastic, both throughout the accession process and the later membership, and perhaps not least because of its still existential fear of Russia. And of course, as I said, and as we also have seen in the Estonian domestic context, it's not that it's been completely somehow uncontroversial or politically not ever contested. Of course, Estonia has its own national conservatives who have also, similarly to voices in Hungary and Poland, viewed Estonia's scaling up of its sovereignty to the level of the EU as something that is very worrying, that is effectively, self-destined political provincialization, potentially leading to the loss of sovereignty, in all and the collapse of the society in the long run, as some have suggested.
Sure.
But I think this is obviously the matter of how one looks at these things politically speaking. I think when we sort of zoom out and look at the Estonian case against the backdrop of also these discussions over the European institutional design and the European identity and the European future and the European constitution as they unfolded in the European Convention, we see that being a small state with a few people and few politicians does not actually mean that you are also automatically peripheral when it comes to envisioning the future, including the constitutional future for Europe. So I think in that sense, it's an interesting instance and interesting case also in political science terms, if you will.
Sure. Professor Malkso, thank you for your musings on the subject of vicarious sovereignty, and thanks again for coming on to History of Estonia podcast.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Nägemist.
Nägemist.
Südametes leegid, laseb käiku privileegid, mida sulle kinkis kroosne kõrg. Põltsamaale loistas kerkib, uued Ivo Schenkenbergi, mõistavad, et nendega on smõrg. Jumal kaitseb kuningat, Jumal kaitse kuningat, Jumal kaitse kuningat, Jumal kaitse kuningat. Rajatakse Nahupoli, Põltsamaale metropoli, Eestimaale kuningriik taas. Tervitame sind, kui tuled, kunagi kui jälle sured, oleme kõik sinu kõrval maas. Jumal kaitse kuningat, Jumal kaitse kuningat, Jumal kaitse kuningat, Jumal kaitse kuningat. Aga siis, kui Taani laevad muuga sadamasse jäävad, tulemata vilja lastiga. Oma kuningannat majast, lohutama lossi ajast, tuleme õunakastiga. Jumal kaitse kuningat, Jumal kaitse kuningat, Jumal kaitse kuningat, Jumal kaitse kuningat. Sulle järgneme kui lubad, maksku veeringud või rublad, rangid, šlaitid, rundstükid või jõõr. Meie maitse, hüüame kõik Jumal kaitse kuningad, kõigi ümber jääb. Jumal kaitse kuningad, Jumal kaitse kuningad, Jumal kaitse kuningad, Jumal kaitse kuningad. Vastatud on ka Tallinn, kroos nõi enese vasalli, Toompeal osis ootavad sind veel. Sulle valid seda jätku, liini kuning riigi jätku, kõnis kadu Eesti enes veel. Jumal kaitse kuningat, Jumal kaitse kuningat, Jumal kaitse kuningat, Jumal kaitse kuningat.
The music for this episode is from the Estonian punk rock band named Venuskond, or Brotherhood in English. The song title is Jumal Kaitse Kuningat, or God Save the King. It plays on the theme of Estonia's European connections at the time of the Livonian War, and the forgotten Estonian SSR at the time of their first album, which came out in 1991. I hope you enjoyed it. I had to play the whole song. Professor Malkso recommended it, and I just love it. I hope you enjoyed it also. Until next time, Nagamist.